Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this evening's edition of the Global Math Department. My name is Lee Natero, and I will be your host tonight. Tonight, we're going to be hearing from Daryl Young about being equity-minded in the teaching of mathematics. Before I introduce our speaker, I would like everyone to introduce themselves in the chat window, telling us what you teach, where you teach, and what your Twitter handle is, if you have one. It's good to see that we have people truly representing the world tonight from Croatia and the United States and Australia. This is pretty amazing. I would say this is definitely one of the most diverse global math departments we've had in a while. Excellent. Excellent. So before I introduce our speaker and turn the presentation over to our speaker, let me explain a little bit about how these meetings work. These meetings are recorded and are available a few hours after the meeting ends. We also have them available in podcast form. That usually takes another 24 hours or so for me to create that. But they are also available on iTunes in podcast form. To view the recording, you would come back to the same URL you used to get here tonight. The Global Math Department community prides itself on being friendly and supportive. The chat room is available for topical and general conversation throughout the meeting. I'll catch your questions for the presenter, so don't worry that he won't notice it in the chatter. Tonight, our speaker is Daryl Young. Daryl is a professor of mathematics at Harvey Mudd College and founding director of the Claremont College Center for Teaching and Learning and instructor for the Teacher Leadership Program at AIS Park City Mathematics Institute. He helped to create Math for America Los Angeles in 2007 and serves on its steering committee. His scholarship has several foci: the retention and professional development of secondary school mathematics teachers, effective teaching practices in undergraduate STEM education, and equity, justice, and diversity in higher education. Welcome, Daryl.
Hi, thanks everyone. Is the audio clear so far? Okay, great, thank you so much. It's a real thrill to be with all of you. I'm really excited and happy to have this chance to chat with all of you. I'll start with a few disclaimers and a few setting the stage kinds of comments. First thing is, we have a very limited amount of time with each other, and so I hope to try to make as much use of the time as possible. I'll try to ask you to interact in at certain points
Daryl?
During
Can
the presentation.
Okay, I cannot hear Daryl. Daryl, if you have a question for me, you'll have to type it in the chat window. Sorry about that.
Okay, but other people can hear me? Okay, that's great. I'm sorry that you won't be able to hear me. Heather isn't able to hear too. Yeah, I apologize about that. Okay, I'm gonna keep going just in the interest of time. I will ask folks to participate from time to time in the chat window, and I apologize. I probably won't be able to catch all your comments, but I'll try my best to highlight the ones that will add to our conversation. Thanks so much. Second thing is, of course, the talk today has to do with equity, and that's obviously the backdrop for everything that we'll discuss today, equity or rather inequity in our educational system. But let's also be clear that in the next 40 or 45 minutes or so, we won't be able to make a huge drop in that issue. There's so many more things we need to do in our world to make more justice, more equity, things at the national level, at the state level, at the district level, at your department level. But right now we're focusing on what we can do individually as teachers, what we can do in the classroom. So that's sort of one caveat first. Second caveat is this talk is likely to leave you with a lot of questions. And if I have done that well, then I think you'll leave the talk with a list of things to think about. I'm not going to be sharing with you a list of equity practices because I think we can do that. But then the contexts that we all teach in are so different. There are people from different countries. Things that I do may not translate for all of you. And so what I will try to do instead with our time together is to help us shift our thinking with regard to equity. The goal for us will be to develop habits of mind that will help us all move toward greater equity and inclusivity in our classrooms. So in other words, the punchline of this talk is try these five things and you'll be a more equitable teacher. Instead, the punchline is we all have more to learn. We all have more to do to be more equitable and inclusive teachers. And here are some habits of mind that might help us to continue that journey, to move farther along that journey. So during our short time today, I will probably raise more questions and concerns than to give you answers. I will try my very best to connect them to practical teaching contexts. But the real work will be for you to take these ideas and consider them carefully and apply them in your own teaching contexts. So in that spirit, the first thing I should probably do is to tell you a little bit about my teaching context so that you know where I'm coming from. I teach at Harvey Mudd College, which is a small science, liberal arts, mathematics, engineering school at Claremont, California, here in Los Angeles. It's part of the Claremont Consortium, so there's actually 7 schools here in Claremont. I've also taught in Los Angeles Unified School District. And for the last few years, I've been the founding director of the Claremont College's Teaching and Learning Center. And what that really is just a professional development organization that supports the teaching and learning for all 600 faculty that we have here at the Claremont Colleges. And let me also just make a quick plug. So another thing that I do is I work very closely with a lot of teachers. So in addition to having taught secondary school mathematics myself, I've also worked with teachers for many years. Currently, I've worked with Math for America Los Angeles. Here's a picture of our 85 plus so teachers in the group right now. And a little plug for anyone who's in the greater Los Angeles area to please look us up if you happen to be here. We would love to connect with you. All right, so I'm going to start here with a quote from one of my favorite scholars, Estela Ben-Simon. She is a professor at University of Southern California, and I'll just read you three sentences from a paper that's cited below. Equity-minded faculty and teachers focus intentionally on the educational outcomes of different groups of students and are able to understand any inequalities in the context of a history of exclusion, discrimination, and educational apartheid. Equity-minded faculty see their institution and themselves, I added that part, as bearing primary responsibility for eliminating those inequitable outcomes rather than making students responsible for overcoming their quote-unquote deficits, such as lack of knowledge, skills, or qualities. And most importantly, equity-minded individuals are far more likely to understand that the beliefs, expectations, and actions of individuals influence whether minority group students are construed as being capable or incapable. So I'd like to take these ideas and make them applicable to the mathematics classroom. So how can we turn ourselves to being more equity-minded? Okay, I see someone is raising a hand. Oh, okay. Apologize, I'll keep going. All right, so let's just start with an exercise, a thinking exercise. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to pose some questions to all of you. You might want to grab a piece of paper to write some thoughts down. And then I'm going to ask you at some point to type some responses in the chat window. Okay, so hope everybody will go and grab a little sheet of paper or something to write with. All right, here we go. So the first question I'd like you to consider is the following. Please think about a student who you perceive to feel a strong sense of belonging in your class. So it could be a current class, or it could be a class from last year. If you've just started teaching, maybe you haven't had a whole lot of experience with your current students. So either think about a current class or a very recent class of students, and think about a student in that class who you perceive to feel a strong sense of belonging. And I would like you to think about an interaction that you had with them that gives you that perception that they feel like they belong in your class. So maybe write down the name of that person, think about that interaction, jot that down on a piece of paper. I'm not going to ask you to share this part. This part is private. Okay, another maybe 5 more seconds. All right, here we go. And then you can see the second prompt already right there. Maybe you've already done it. Now I'd like you to think about a student who you perceive to feel a lack of belonging in your class for whatever reason. Think about an interaction that you had with them that gives you that perception that they think that they don't belong, or you think that they don't belong. So jot down the name of that person on a piece of paper, and maybe an interaction that we had with them that makes you think that they didn't belong. And if I'm not giving you enough time, just maybe just say so in the chat window, and I'll give people more time to think about this. Okay, about 10 more seconds. All right, here is the next question for all of you. Okay, you ready? Number 3, what is one thing you wish students would do more of in your classes to succeed? So I'll give you an example. For me, I wish my students would come to my office and ask me questions when they get stuck. So think about what it is that you wish your students would do more of to be successful in your class. And this one, you can either write it down, or if you feel so inclined, feel free to type your response into the chat window. And maybe I'll give about a minute or so. We'll see how many responses we get. Keep it coming. These are great responses that you're all typing in. I really resonate with you all about talking, who are talking about risk taking in the classroom. Okay, great. So I think we'll move on to the last two questions. These last two questions are going to be very quick. And if you are willing to, this is going to require you to type in a quick yes, a no, or a question mark into the chat window. Okay? So here is the fourth question for you. Question number four. Now I want you to think about the student that you wrote about previously who feels like a strong sense of belonging. And I want to know, did that student do the thing that you said in question three? That one thing, did that student who has a sense of belonging, did they do that thing? So just type yes, no, or question mark if you don't know. And we'll just see the stream of yeses and nos. Okay, about five more seconds for folks to type in a yes or a no or a question mark. Okay, now here is the last question. I'm going to put in a little comment to separate out. So now the responses below are going to be for that last question. And I think maybe you're guessing where I'm going next. So I want you now to think about the student who you felt did not have a strong sense of belonging in your classroom. Did that student do the thing that you just said? Let's see, a yes or a no or a question mark. Okay, about maybe five more seconds to get some responses in. All right, so I hope that little exercise invokes some thoughts for you. For me, it tells me that belongingness really matters. It's not just this warm feeling that I have with other people around me, but it really affects the way that our students participate, their desire to learn, their level of engagement, their effort, their self-confidence. So you can see that in the chat window, we've noticed a lot more people said that the thing that they wish they wanted students to do, more students did them if they had a strong sense of belonging than if they didn't have a strong sense of belonging. And I would argue that there's a pretty strong connection between student behavior and their sense of belonging in the classroom. That sense of belonging can apply to also the sense of belonging within the school, and maybe at a smaller scale, sense of belonging with the people, with the students directly around them, for example, if they're working in a small group. So that belongingness matters a lot. And the reason I bring up this exercise is because just reminding us all that there are very important connections to behavior when we feel like we're safe and that we belong. I put on the screen here Maslow's hierarchy of needs. This is a important idea in most Psych 101 courses. If you've taken an introductory psychology course, you probably ran across this idea. This theory has to do with what motivates people to do the things that they do. So it's a very general theory, but when you apply it to the classroom, I think it has some very significant impacts too. It helps us to think about the ways in which we help our students feel safe in the classroom, to feel like they belong, to feel like they have a sense of self-esteem. And those are important motivators to help them continue working, to try harder, to do all of those things that you just mentioned in question number three. And the reason I bring this up also is because no matter in what context you teach, there are going to be situations in which people don't feel like they have as much of a sense of belonging by virtue of their identities. So, for example, in the United States, women and students of color, particularly Black, African American, Hispanic, Latinx, Native American students, feel like they don't belong in a mathematics classroom because they're not as numerically represented in the images of mathematicians and scientists that they see around them. And probably they're not represented well in the science community within your local context too. So they're receiving messages all the time that they don't belong in science and engineering and the mathematics. And that lack of sense of belonging can translate itself into the classroom. So what can we do about that? So here is the punchline of our time together. I'm just going to tell you now, and then we're going to spend the rest of our time sort of unpacking and thinking through its implications. So what I'm proposing to all of us is, instead of thinking about specific practices in the classroom that are equitable or not equitable, let's get in the habit of asking ourselves a set of questions every time we make instructional choices. So here are some equity-oriented habits of mind that I would like to propose for all of us. So let's get in the practice of asking ourselves these questions anytime we make instructional choices, whether they're big or small ones. Who's likely to benefit? Who might not benefit from those choices? Who might feel included or a sense of belonging, or feel excluded or a lack of sense of belonging? And how would I know if I had to intervene in some way? And that third question I find pretty difficult and also at the same time relevant, because I would imagine and I bet that most of us in this space right now are well-intentioned people. If we knew that there was a problem in our class or we were doing something that was marginalizing or alienating a specific group of people, we would fix that. But the problem is, how would we know if we didn't perceive that there was a problem? How would we fix it if we didn't detect that that was an issue? Students are really great at hiding their feelings, and they don't want us to know sometimes that they're not feeling like they belong. And so they often are really great at hiding things from us. I should pause and see. I think there are a few questions in the Q&A box. So I see there's a question here about, does this activity and talking about belonging, is it correlation or causation? Is it a problem of how we think belonging and success look, as opposed to how we think it looks? So I'm not really sure whether it's a direct correlation or causation. It could be either way. I guess one of the issues that I would I've experienced in the time as a teacher myself is that belongingness has to do with the things that I do in my classroom, and it in turn causes students to feel either like they belong or not belong. So either you walk in a space already feeling like you belong, and then the things that happen in my classroom reinforce that behavior or that belief in yourself, or sometimes you walk in a space and that doesn't happen. Okay, let me also just pause and see. Cynthia, I see you have a hand raised. Okay, Cynthia, I hope, and anyone else too, if you have a question, feel free to type your question in the chat window and I'll stop myself, but maybe in the interest of time, I'll keep going. If anyone has a question, please just type a note in the chat box and hopefully we'll catch it. All right, so what I would like us to do next is to practice thinking through these questions in some specific teaching context. And I've chosen one that I hope will resonate with many of you. So let's just start with the first one. Okay, so I bet many of you interact with your students through a think, pair, share. So for example, I pose a question and then I ask people to talk with their neighbors and then I ask for some people to share out to the large group. So that's a pretty common teaching routine. And in that context, so here's a picture of me in my classroom. And I've just done a think, pair, share, and right now students are talking with each other, and then I'm about to solicit responses for the whole group. Okay, so what I would like us to do is to think through these three questions. Whenever we do a think, pair, share in the classroom, who is likely to benefit? Who might not benefit as much? Who might feel included? Who might feel excluded? Who might feel a sense of belonging or a lack of belonging? And then that third question, how would I know if I had to intervene in some way, to do something differently? Okay, so what I'll do is I'll put those questions out there. I'll give you just a few seconds to think, and I'm going to start that thinking process by giving you some of my thoughts. Okay, so here's a start to some of these answers. And this is just a partial answer to the question. You will have to think about what this looks like in your own classroom too. So as I think about my own teaching practice and the practices of teachers that I've visited in their classrooms, I recognize that this think, pair, share teaching strategy often gets shortcutted to just pair and share. So in other words, the think part gets skipped. So in other words, you know, it's something like, hey, everyone, what do you think is the correct next step to take in this procedure? Talk with your neighbor. Turn to your neighbor and ask them, you know. So you just pose the question and you immediately ask people to talk to the person next to them. And I think, unfortunately, what that does is it tends to benefit people who are extroverted, who are more willing to talk off the cuff, who are less likely to feel inhibited. So at least in American culture, I think there's a tendency to value people who are extroverted, who are willing to talk sort of off the cuff. And so when you pose a question and do the pair and then an immediate, and then you ask for sharing, if you're not careful about who you ask to talk first in the pair or how the pairing happens, probably what is going to happen is the person who feels more confident or feels more extroverted is going to share in that moment. So let's think also about who is likely to benefit and who might not. So I happen to be a person who is rather introverted. I dislike having to talk off the top of my head. I prefer to have a few moments to be able to put my thoughts together. Who else might also appreciate having a few more moments to think to themselves before having to talk to a neighbor? Would you think about that question? Yeah. Students for whom English is not a first language. That's right. Who else do you think might appreciate having a few seconds just to think and form their thoughts? Yes, thank you for all the folks who are talking about students that might have learning disabilities, differences in the way they process information. That's right. Great, thanks so much. And as a result of this happening over and over and again in the classroom, you can imagine that if you weren't careful about the way you were doing think, pair, share, you might set up a situation in which, let's say you have everyone sitting in pairs, the same person is the person who always talks first and gets their ideas out first. And so that might over time lead you to pull back, to think that your contributions are not as valued as others. And so what I'm suggesting here is perhaps there might be some intervention that you might need to make in your classroom in order to make the think, pair, share a more equitable experience. So one thing already that I've mentioned is perhaps just adding in the think, that really adding the think time to make sure that people have a chance to think about a question that's naughty, I mean, K-N-O-T-T-Y, naughty, worth thinking about before you ask them just to talk to the person next to them. Another nice trick that I see a lot of people doing is having some way of saying who speaks first. So perhaps you might say, oh, the person sitting closest to the door will talk first this time. And then you might switch it up so that the next time the person on the other side will talk first. And that's if the pairs happen to be already formed in with the furniture in your room, or maybe you have to have some way of forming the pairs so that there's not as weird a situation when you have to rely on people to form their pairs naturally in the classroom. Okay, so I hope this is all making sense for folks. If you do have questions, please, please, please stop me and interrupt. And then, but on the way, I'll just kind of keep going. So the third question here is the one I'd like to focus on next. So in the think, pair, share context, what would you look at in the room? How would you know if you had to intervene in some way? How would you know if there was a problem that was happening because of your think, pair, share? So I'd love for you to consider that question and then share some of your responses in the chat. Yeah, I agree with all of you who's talking about pairs that are not talking. Not talking when everyone else is talking is often, it could be a sign, but I would want to look at them more carefully to see what's going on. Maybe they are actually thinking and that's a good thing, but if they're not talking and they continue not talking, that could be an issue. Yeah, students who feel shut down are also of concern, and that's often difficult to tell. It could be their body language that gives you some signs. If they're not looking at each other or not looking at the task at hand, that could be a little bit of a signal to you. Yeah, if people aren't talking about the thing that you're asking them to talk about, that could also be an issue. It could be that the task that you've given them isn't clear or not something that they feel like they can answer. And so the off-task behavior is often the way that students express their desire to feel capable in the classroom is to have a conversation about something else that they think they can talk about instead of the one that you want them to talk about. All right, folks, any more final comments about the think, pair, share? So the plan for the evening here is to finish off the talk by going through a couple more different contexts. And each time I'm going to ask us to think through these same three questions. So any more comments about think, pair, share? Cool. Thank you for your comments in the chat box. All right, so let's move on to the next context. I think another one that happens very typically in a math classroom is we ask students to work in small groups on tasks. Okay, so I have here a picture from my class. I have students working, they're doing an activity, they're all in threes, there's a computer, there's some materials that are at play. So I don't know how small group work looks like in your classroom. Maybe your furniture is different or your groups persist for a long time or just for the day or whatever it is. But whatever your context is, think about this context. When you ask students to work in small groups on a mathematical task, who do you think is benefiting the most? Who might not benefit as much? Who might feel included or excluded? And how would you know if you had to intervene in some way? So I'll give you, this is a meaty question, so I'll give you maybe about 30 seconds to think. So before we get going with the conversation in earnest, I'll just share some of my own experiences doing group work. I try to do a lot of group work in my courses. Typically, these are courses that last either an hour or 90 minutes or so. And these small group tasks are usually either part of the class or the whole class. Sometimes they last for more than one class period, but often it's just in the moment groups that are formed. I have various ways of forming those groups. But they don't always go well. Sometimes they do go well. And I put a picture here of one that happens. They happen to be pretty happy looking, so I'm glad that someone noticed that. I remember once, a few years ago, I asked a group of students to work on a set of problems. I didn't give them any instructions on how to work well with each other, and the problems were rather routine ones. And that created a situation in which one student felt left behind in her group. It was a group of one young woman and two men. And I noticed over time that the young woman was not participating, not talking. The other two men were talking to each other. They kind of left her out of the conversation. And after the class, I made sure to go back and just check in with her to see how she was doing. She said, she was very dismissive. Oh, I was fine. You know, I felt unprepared for this class. And she talked about how maybe she didn't have the right prerequisite knowledge. And I assured her that that wasn't the case, that would be fine. Then I never saw her again. That student dropped my class. I sent her several emails. I tried to reach out to her, but she never wrote back to me. And I never saw her in my class again. So I can't be sure that the experience that she had in the group work was what related to her dropping my class, but I have very strong suspicions that that was the case. And so I think group work is amazing, and don't get me wrong, I don't want anybody to leave my talk today thinking, oh, Daryl says don't do group work because it can sometimes not work out well for students. That's probably always going to be true about anything we do in the classroom. There are going to be unintended side effects. The question here is, how can we be more intentional in our work so as to reduce those unintentional side effects for students, to make the experience more equitable for everyone? So let's think through again for this particular set. I think some of you are already wondering about question one. I see some folks that Dina said, kids who might need more processing time might not benefit as much. That could be true, depending on how the task was set up. But let's think about that first question. So who is likely to benefit and who might not in a small group kind of setting? What do you all think? Sam, I agree with you a lot about groups with members who already feel comfortable talking with each other will benefit quite a lot. Groups, in which students don't feel safe sharing their ideas aren't going to benefit. And we all know that math can be a very scary activity for a lot of students. And so you're right that there needs to be some norms established. And Peter is asking a great question. Sam, do you let students choose their own groups? And this is a big question that we can get into a discussion about. So do you set the groups up yourself? If you do, do you use homogeneous grouping, heterogeneous grouping? Do you group randomly? Do you visibly randomly group? There's so many things we can talk about there. People are talking about how he's using playing cards to randomly assign. I personally visibly randomly assign as well. I think that has some important effects, but I think it depends a lot in your context. And the answer to that question will have to come from your own thinking about these issues. Let me just pause for a second, having to do with these questions, and just talk a bit more about that experience that I had. In reflecting on the experience that I had in group work and why that particular young woman didn't have a good experience, I realized that one of the biggest problems that I see in my own work and the work of others has to do with the task itself. So let me pause here and talk a bit about the mathematics of the task. So one of the reasons why group work doesn't work well in the mathematics classroom is because the task that we give students actually doesn't really require them to work in groups. For example, if you gave people a list of whatever class you have, so if you're in a calculus class, give them a list of, 20 derivatives to calculate and just say, here, work on this in groups. That task is likely to exacerbate the inequities that exist in the classroom as opposed to helping students learn how to work with each other. And the reason for that is because the task of calculating 20 derivatives is really not a group task. I don't need you to be able to calculate 20 derivatives if I already know how to do them myself. If I give you a task like that, it's probably going to make it even more clear who in the group is good, quote unquote good. And that could be often measured by how fast people perform a particular task. And so that particular task is likely to exacerbate any differences that might already exist in groups, helping some students to feel like they're better, quote unquote, better at math than others, and others to feel like they're, quote unquote, not as good as math as others. And so just a reminder to all of you, I hope you've run across this work by Rachel Lotan and others. The people who do complex instruction at Stanford have thought a lot about these things. So there are, here according to Rachel Lotan's paper, group-worthy tasks, there are five important characteristics for tasks that are really worthwhile for small groups of people to do. So one, they're open-ended and require complex problem solving. Two, they have multiple entry points and ways to show competence. Three, they involve intellectually important content. Four, require positive interdependence and individual accountability. That for me is the most difficult one. And five, having a clear criteria for the evaluation of the group's product. Now, you may or may not find all five of these to be applicable in every situation. Sometimes if the task is a short-lived task, like a 5-minute or 10-minute task, you may not have number five, for example. And also there are certainly norms that you can set up in place. You can also use roles to try to accommodate for some of these group-worthy features of tasks. But the underlying mathematical task is what I'm asking about right here. Is it a juicy, meaty mathematical task that really requires several brains to work on together? If I don't feel like I need you and you need me, then it's less likely that I'm actually going to take your comments seriously. I might dismiss them easily, more easily than I would if I thought I really needed to consider your viewpoint. Coming up with group-worthy tasks is a challenge. I think it's a big challenge for folks. And so that's maybe one of the first things I'll say having to do with group-worthy tasks. But going back to the questions again, so in the context of your own situation, let's think through who else might you consider would feel like they were included or excluded in a particular situation. And how would you know if you had to intervene? So if you have any comments about questions two or three, feel free to type them in the chat window. and hopefully we can get a little discussion going. Thank you, Tracy, for your question. Can we have a concrete example of a problem for this type of group work? So I can give you the example that you see in the picture right there. So this was a class in which students were learning about confidence intervals and linear regression. And so the task at the moment of when this picture was taken was for all of the students in the class to collect data that they later analyzed. The data that they collected was typed into a Google spreadsheet, and everyone had a different row that they were typing into. And the variables they were collecting were, how many marbles can you hold in one hand? And then the other variable was, what is your hand span? So using the ruler that's shown there, measure from the tip of one finger, if you were to expand your finger as far as possible, measure from one end to the other end, and then record those two things together. And as you can imagine, those two variables are very closely related. And so then as the data was collected for the whole class, we then performed linear regression on that data, and then they calculated confidence intervals on prediction values that were made. So that was the particular group task that they were given at that moment. So with regard to question three, I find that this question of how you can tell when group work is going well or not going well is often a little bit tricky. So as we talked about earlier with the think, pair, share, you can look at the groups and see who's talking. Is somebody dominating the conversation? I also tend to really pay attention to whose ideas get taken up. So if somebody puts forward a suggestion to the group, what happens to that suggestion? Does it get ignored? Does it get taken up seriously? That's often a little bit tricky to tell when there's so many groups going on at the same time. One of the tricks that I try to use is just to have my ear turned to as many groups as possible as I'm walking around the room. So I'm typically not answering very many questions. I'm trying to save my attention so that I can attend to group status issues within the classroom. I try to encourage students to ask each other questions as much as possible, and only to ask me when they really need my help. Karen is asking, does the problem itself create the engagement or the teacher? Oh, I'm not sure. That's an interesting question. Hopefully it's both. I agree with you, Lee. I hope that it's both things. I hope that you catch my enthusiasm for the task, but then hopefully when you see the data, it's an interesting question you might ask yourself about. All right, so let's move on to another context. And this is just, maybe we'll just pause quickly on this one because this is a related one. So here's a very similar kind of thing that you might do in your classroom. And in this context, we have students working in small groups, but this time they're working at a board. So if you like, you could say a vertical non-permanent surface or a whiteboard or whatever it is. If you have whiteboards or chalkboards or on a piece of paper in a group, some way of recording their work so as to be visible, but also not permanent. So maybe in the interest of time, we won't go through all of these issues here, but one of the things that I want to ask here is, who is likely to benefit, who might not? there again, I think there's always a question about whose work gets put up on the board. If you're not careful, when I'm not careful, I find sometimes there's one person who dominates in the group whose ideas get valued and valored in the group and whose ideas get put on the board, and other people's ideas are not listened to as well. And so there needs to be some way in order for groups to know how to share their ideas with each other. That could be done in the form of having strong group norms established in advance, or maybe some other mechanism by which you control who talks. So for example, thank you, having them switch after a few minutes. So one strategy that I've used and that works well for me is I make sure that each person has a different colored marker, and I ask students to make sure that all three colors and all three handwriting styles are visible on the board when I walk around the room. I should be able to see all of their contributions on the board. Another one is I ask students not to talk if they're holding the pen and writing. So that also helps. Brad is bringing a few points. Students that might have some physical issues might find it hard to be at the board. So sometimes board height is an issue. If you have a student that's perhaps in a wheelchair, that may present some mobility issues. And so there might need to be some other things you have to think about in your classroom. All right, I'm going to jump to, since this is very similar to the one before, I'm going to jump to one that's a little bit different now. So for our third context, probably our last one for the evening, let's think about open-ended projects. So I have a funny picture about a science poster, science fair project that's on the screen, but that's not really the point here. What I have in mind is, in your own classroom, do you use or do you have students do some sort of open-ended or culminating project in the class? It could be writing a biography of a mathematician, or it could be putting together a portfolio. You know, there are all kinds of different things that you might you can imagine in this category. They could be done individually or in groups. And when you assign those kinds of open-ended projects to students, again, I would ask those same questions, the same set of questions: who's likely to benefit, who might not, and of course, how might you try to change it so that more students would benefit, who might feel included or not included, and how would you know if you had to intervene? So I'll pose those questions here, and I'll just pause for a minute to see if folks have any immediate reactions, but if not, I'm going to jump in. Okay, so I'll jump in here. One of the things that I would encourage you all to think about with regards to open-ended projects and other kinds of culminating projects that you assign for your courses is to think really carefully about the assignment instructions that you give to your students. So in this sort of scenario, whenever there's a lot of student agency and choice, student agency is obviously a really wonderful thing. It can really increase motivation in the project and in the learning. For some students, it can be paralyzing to have so much choice. So think carefully about the balance between choice and clear instructions, ways in which students would be able to find and ask questions about their projects so that they're not stuck at sea. One of the suggestions that I've really encouraged folks to try too is to take your instructions for your open-ended project and bring them to a colleague in a different department. So maybe bring your activity to an English teacher and ask them to read through the instructions to see what questions they might have. Oftentimes, we've been so steeped in learning and in teaching that we have assumptions and things that we've already assimilated in our brains that help us to perform these kinds of tasks well. And students who haven't learned how to play school as well, who haven't had a lot of experience, or maybe they just haven't experienced these kinds of projects as much in their prior learning, might not benefit as much if they encounter these kinds of projects with, and they have a lot of questions. And so the task here is how to write instructions that are clear enough so that all students will be able to have an entry point into the task and will be able to learn. And yet enough creativity and room for exploration so that students don't feel like they're being locked into something that they aren't interested in. And of course, if there are ways in which you can allow students to tie in the learning to their personal experiences, that's always a wonderful thing to do. I agree with the comment that was just typed in. Students with families who have the economic means to buy project materials can often benefit. So that's often something to think about too. So what are the materials required, and how might you create a situation in which the materials aren't really the issue here, and they're not the limiting factor to a student producing wonderful top-rated work. All right, so I hope that just through these three contexts that you already get a sense that these are questions that I think can apply in many different situations. And what I'm trying to say here is that in the process of becoming a more equitable teacher, what we do is we try to make sure that we ask ourselves these questions more and more frequently. It's almost like a habit of mind that we get ourselves into, so that we are always looking out for how we can make ourselves and our practice more equitable, how we can avoid having unintended effects for our students. So I think what I'll do is I'll stop here and I'll leave it open for questions and comments.
Thank you very much, Terrell. This will be posted in about 24 hours, so please make sure to come back if you want to view this presentation again. Thank you once again, Daryl. And if there are any questions, please feel free to post them in the chat window. I can post the slides at the Global Math Department along with the presentation, so those can be there. Thank you very much. Everyone have a good evening. Oh, and by the way, before I forget, next week we do have a speaker lined up. That speaker is Judy Larson. Judy will be speaking on the topic of thinking classrooms. I hope you can return next week. Have a good evening, everyone.